John Potter and other top postal officials appear before a House subcommittee today. The post office went $2.8 billion into the red last year and is facing even larger losses this year due to the sharp decline in mail volume in the weak economy. Postal officials are trying to turn to Congress for help. Potter has raised the possibility of cutting mail delivery from 6 days a week to five. He is also seeking relief from the requirement to set aside several $1 billion annually to pre-fund retiree medical care. Last week, the post office said it plans to offer early retirement to 150,000 workers. It is also eliminating 1,400 management positions. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, opening a digital and print photography space in Los Angeles at annenbergspaceforphotography.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILO programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Both the programs today come from the Focus Archives. They're both shows that we first broadcast in December of last year. The first one is a conversation with the author of a book about Warren Buffett. And in hour two, historian Neil Ferguson talks about his book, The Ascent of Money. It's a history of money and finance and financial institutions around the world. So as you listen to the programs this morning, do keep in mind that today on Focus 580, we'll not be taking calls. Warren Buffett is well known as one of the world's most successful investors. He's also a very private person who has turned down many offers to write a memoir or a book on his business principles. Now, however, we have what is probably the closest thing that we will ever get to an autobiography. It's a new account of his life written with his full cooperation. And this morning, we'll be talking with the author, Alice Schroeder. The title of the book is The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. It's recently published. Bantam is the publisher. So you can go out and you can look for it in the bookstore, and a lot of interesting things in the book, and we'll be talking about that this morning. Let me tell you a little bit more about the author. She was a Wall Street analyst and managing director at Morgan Stanley when she decided, at Mr. Buffett's suggestion, to go into writing full-time. She was born in Texas, earned her undergraduate degree and MBA at University of Texas at Austin before moving east to work in finance. She is a former CPA, now makes her home in Connecticut, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Schroeder, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Is this David?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes. Glad that you could be with us. How long have you known Warren Buffett?
It's been 11 years now.
Okay. So, and how was it that you happened to meet first?
I was a Wall Street analyst, and I worked at Paine Webber at the time. I was following insurance stocks. And his company, Berkshire Hathaway, bought a company that I followed, General Re. And in connection with that, I decided to pick up coverage on Berkshire, meaning tell investors whether to buy or sell it. And I happened to be the only analyst that had ever done that. So he ended up meeting me, and he decided that he would talk to me, and he would meet with me once a year and talk to me on the phone whenever I had a question. So for 5 years, we had a business relationship.
And so that I guess that and the fact that he apparently did encourage you to go into writing, all of that would explain why he might ask you to do this project. And this book, it was his idea?
There was something from the very beginning. I issued my first report on Berkshire in 1999 in January. And when he read it, he called me and he said, you have an unusual way of thinking. Maybe you should be doing something else. And I wrote this down. I didn't really think about it, but he never says anything lightly. And so periodically after that, he would say, I think you should quit your job and write a book. And I would say, but Warren, you know, what would I write about? And he'd say, oh, you'll think of something. And he has an almost obsession with always making sure that everything is the other person's idea. He never wants to be responsible for other people's choices. So he would nudge me this way. But in the end, it was my idea, and I volunteered. I came up with this idea in the spring of 2003 after another writer approached me to write a different book. And I knew Warren liked the way I write, and I actually thought he should be the author. I've always thought he should write a book, but he doesn't want to do it. And so I ended up volunteering.
Okay. So this this would explain why it is that he might have asked you to be involved in this project, or that he might have thought when you asked him that would be something he'd want to be involved in and he could work with you. So all of that would explain that. What is still in, I'm sure, a lot of people's minds an open question is, given the fact that for such a long time he seemed to resist doing this, or at least doing this himself, why it is that he decided to be involved in this and be apparently as open and accessible as he was.
Yeah, that's a great question. He had always planned to write a book and in the end had abandoned that project a few years before this one began because he just didn't want to spend the time. He had decided with his friend Carol Loomis to do something jointly, but they both wanted to edit. Neither one of them wanted to write. And so he was looking for a writer. And I understood Berkshire Hathaway, I understood insurance, I understood the business, you know, and he likes the way I write. But the real question that you've just touched on is, why was he so open? He told me that he wanted to reconcile his public and private selves. And after Katharine Graham, his close friend, died, he commented a number of times on her memoir. And it was remarkably candid. She really opened herself up about her husband, who was very cruel to her, and her mother, who was really abusive. And that memoir is considered one of the best really ever written. And he saw that people admired her for telling the truth about herself and making herself vulnerable. So I, you know, believe that on at least one level, he saw that the person that people worship in public, this awe-inspiring grandfatherly figure, isn't real. It's just one aspect of him. And he wanted people to know him.
And there's something he apparently said to you that seems pretty striking, something for those people who might say, well, he was just interested in something that would put him in a favorable light, and that's this thing that he apparently said: look, if you're talking to people about me and I've told you some kind of a story, and then you go to somebody else who had some angle on this, and they tell you a different version of the story, whichever one is the least flattering for me, that's the one that you should go with.
Yes, he did say that. Now, in fairness, you know, in addition to being self-deprecating, he was keenly aware that humility is disarming. And I think also he knew me, and he knew that I was going to do whatever I wanted anyway. So, you know, I think that it was somewhat strategic on his part, you know, as well as a genuine openness. But it worked out.
Well, we need to get into the story here, but maybe just one other sort of general question. There, I think here you're really telling two kind of stories in a sense, and one of them is his personal story about himself, his childhood, his parents, his relationship with the women in his life, his relationship with his children, all those sorts of things. And then there's also a story here about his experiences in business and how he thinks. And it seems that, you know, there might be two kinds of people who would be interested in reading this book. One group that would be interested in the personal story of Warren Buffett. And then there are people who say, oh, I don't care about that stuff. What I want essentially is Warren Buffett's Guide to Making a Bazillion Dollars. And, you know, those are two sort of different things. And I think the people who want the one book aren't interested in the other. And I wonder how it is you thought about those two storylines and how you wanted to balance the two, and why, in fact, that you felt that you wanted to do both.
I wanted to write a biography of this man, and to write that, you had to explain his business achievements. I knew that people who wanted an investing book, meaning they wanted to learn how to invest like him, were actually going to be disappointed. But those who wanted to understand his business accomplishments would learn how he did that, similar to someone who read a biography of, say, a J.P. Morgan. There's a lot of his business career in there, too. Or, you know, if you read Katharine Graham's memoir, there's an unbelievable amount about the newspaper business in there, which, you know, you might find almost tedious if you don't care about newspapers. So inherently, in a biography of a business person, there's going to be a lot of that business content. But one thing that I also thought was very important, I knew that having this incredible access that I had, there would be people who had an expectation that there was some secret there, that there was some secret to his investing that I could reveal that told how he did it that, you know, could make you a billionaire. And the actual answer is there's not a secret. You know, he's told people how he invests. And so what the book shows you is how he really did it. There's no trick, but he worked incredibly hard for many years. And the book walks you through his life showing the intensity and the focus with which he did that. And that's the real secret.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, just to quickly reintroduce, is Alice Schroeder. She's the author of a new biography of Warren Buffett. The title is The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. It's published by Bantam. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you to talk about the title, because that is a metaphor, refers to a metaphor that for him is very important.
The snowball is from a saying of his that life is like a snowball, and the important thing is finding wet snow and a really long hill. And he talked to me, I included this near the end of the book, about the fact that he packed his snowball early, and that the snowball is not just money, but it's relationships, and it's how you spend your time, and it's learning and knowledge. And the snowball is about compounding. It's about the way things grow over time. And he said, you've got to be your own wet snow. You've got to find your right focus. And the long hill is starting as early as you can.
He apparently, from a very young age, was determined to be successful and to make money. And there's a story here. It talks about the fact that when he was a kid, there was some sort of moment of epiphany where he made a snowball and he rolled it along a little bit and it got bigger. And he thought, huh, how about that? And then he pushed it along a little bit more and it got bigger still. And that from that, he sort of started thinking about this idea that once you make a dollar, you could go out and spend it. But there also is the potential for, in a sense, reinvesting that dollar and growing that dollar, and pretty soon you're going to have two, and then you're going to have 10, and then you're going to have 100. And that's something of the secret of his success. Was he really saying that when he was 10 years old or whenever this event happened, that at that point he had that kind of insight?
Absolutely. There's a little anecdote at the beginning of the book that about him rolling a snowball that's just a metaphor that explains the concept. But what happened really was, and I relate this in the book, that he found a book at his grandfather's house called 1,000 Ways to Make $1,000. And it explained the math of compounding, that if you invest $10 today, over time, 10 years later, 7 years later, it becomes $100. Or 20 years later, it becomes $100. And he began thinking of money in the sense that if you had the $10 today, it was the same as having the $100. So he became reluctant to spend. He thought of everything in terms of what it would be worth tomorrow. And that became a very central concept to his life.
And that's one of the things that I suppose a lot of people will know about him, is that it seemed that he's someone who would much rather make money than spend it, and has famously lived relatively speaking, a modest lifestyle given how much money he has. He certainly could live the life of luxury. He's one of those people that he could afford to have anything that he wanted, and lots of cars and big houses and airplanes, and he could go out and buy baseball teams and, you know, do whatever it is the extremely wealthy people do, and he never did any of that.
if you have $60 billion, there aren't a lot of limitations on your life. That is absolutely true. And he lives an almost austere lifestyle. He uses a jet to get around in because he likes the convenience. But his house, you should just see it. I mean, it is not it's not small, but it's it could use some redecorating. His taste is really simple, and he's just oblivious. He doesn't collect art. He's never had a yacht. You know, his car, I will never forget his daughter telling me about how he is so cheap when he buys a car that once she had to search every surrounding county at car dealerships for a car, and she finally found one that had been damaged by hail, and it was cheap enough that he was willing to buy it. So there is this, it's a combination of thriftiness and disinterest in material things that have made him to into a quite almost an aesthetic.
So then what's the point? I guess then one would say, what's the point if it's not about, you know, some people, I suppose, want to make a lot of money for the things that a lot of money will buy. Well, clearly for him, that's not the point. So what is the point?
The point is amassing it. He had, getting into psychoanalyzing a little bit, but he early on sort of developed a feeling of needing the money to feel complete. And he wants more. And so if you spend it, he feels diminished. So he just wants to accumulate it. He's a collector. He collects all sorts of things. He's collected stamps and coins. And what his favorite thing to collect is cash. And collectors just want more of whatever it is they collect. It's a psychological thing. They're always looking for the search for more of whatever it is they want, and that's Warren.
You're trying to learn the secret of somebody's life or explain why it is they became the person that they are. Obviously, you look at their life experiences and you go back to their childhood, and one of the things that people, I'm sure, are interested in, they want to know, what kind of family did he come out of? And it seems that his parents, as with all of us, I suppose, his parents had a lot to do with the person that he became. Tell us about his father and his mother.
His family, in some ways, was traditional for that time in that, the father went off to work and the mother raised the children. But in other ways, I think a lot of people might not want to trade places with him. His father was a rigid and rather cold man. He was a U.S. congressman, and he was a stockbroker, and he was very moralistic. His children learned to be very honest and principled, but as his Warren sister said, nobody ever tucked us into bed with a kiss. Nobody ever told us a bedtime story. No one ever said, I love you, in their family, ever. Warren's mother, Leela, was someone who had grown up in a terrible family of her own. Her mother and grandmother both died in mental institutions. Her sister, one of them committed suicide, and the other died in a mental institution. There was something not right about her, and no one knows exactly what, but she had a cheery Betty Crocker kind of personality that she would display to the world. But to her children, she would suddenly erupt for no provocation whatsoever and begin screaming at them, and she would carry on for an hour or longer about the fact that they were worthless and they should be ashamed to exist, and she would pick at every flaw. And Warren said that by the time he was 3 years old, he was broken and it couldn't be put back together.
I suppose when you engage in biography, it is, in a sense, a kind of amateur psychology, or at least for those of us who come to the book, that's one of the things that we are doing. And it does seem tempting to want to look at him and look at his life and say, on the one hand, that by his life, what he was trying to do was to make himself into a person who was completely different from the people that his parents were, a different man from his father, to deal with this idea that his mother always sort of communicated to him and his sister that they'd never amount to anything, and that at the same time that in his relationships with men who were his mentors and with the women in his life, he seemed to be looking for fathers and mothers.
That's right. There's there's psychobiography where the biographer directly tries to psychoanalyze the subject, and I really avoided that. But, you know, in a good biography, you know, you do point out the patterns. And there was a very clear pattern that you just described where Warren started as a child, and he would go around the neighborhood, and he would seek out the parents of his friends or his aunts or even his parents' own friends, and he would look for anyone who could be a surrogate parent to him. And he continued doing that throughout his life. He's always looked for these protective figures. He also emulated his father in being a stockbroker, being in finance, and also in his desire to be someone who is an exemplar of these high moral principles. And at the same time, he's wanted to be seen as someone who was warmer and friendlier than anybody in his family. And he's really, really sensitive to criticism and to particularly the idea that he would criticize anyone else.
Yeah, having said all that, I certainly don't mean to suggest anything untoward in your relationship with Mr. Buffett, but that had you thought about why he picked you to be his amanuensis in this project?
Oh, yeah, you better believe it. you know, when you look at Warren in the media, you'll usually see him with a young, attractive female reporter. And he tends to surround himself with women who are motherly and protective. He always is looking for that mother figure. When I worked on Wall Street, I knew him strictly as a business figure. But when I began working on this biography, of course, I didn't know this side of him. But I quickly figured it out, and I saw this enormous trap. It was something that could absolutely suck you in. And I had to, I had to make a choice. Was I going to be the biographer, or was I going to become one of his circle of people that protected him through the writing of this book? And I decided that, and it was not an easy or fun decision, but I decided that after this book was published, there was a possibility, if I did my job right, that he would never speak to me again. That he might even be vindictive, that his powerful friends, you know, might be angry and become vindictive. And, you know, if that's what it took, that's what it took. But that I could not, people would say to me in interviews, don't write this, don't write that, it'll hurt Warren or it'll hurt Susie. You know, I couldn't write that way. You know, I had to avoid the entanglements. And so I worked very hard at that.
So how does he feel about the book that resulted?
He's made a couple of public statements. He said that it's good. He said that it's well-written. He's read it. He didn't ask for any changes. Interestingly, he and I have not had a direct conversation about what he thinks about it. He never criticizes anything. He only gives praise when he likes. He has not been enthusiastic in public about this book. I have heard and I believe that he's quite ambivalent. There's parts of it that were very painful for him to read and made him very, very uncomfortable. I think that's natural. If the book was honest, of course, some parts of it wouldn't jibe with his self-perception. And there were parts of it about his personal life that were, it probed very deeply. And we never really got back fully into the question of why he was so open. I mean, I told you my theory, but still, it's very unusual to find a biography where the subject opens up, even when their intentions are. I mean, it was a remarkable experience to have him be so open, and then out it comes on the page. And, of course, I think he's ambivalent.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Alice Schroeder. She's the author of a new biography of Warren Buffett. The title is The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, published by Bantam. We have some callers here. We'd like to bring them into the conversation. We'll take them in the order they came in, and we'll start with line number one right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Quick comment. I have a very close personal friend who lives just down the street from Warren, and I can say that that's a nice, tight, folksy little neighborhood in Omaha. It's an older neighborhood, but really quite neat. My friend's kids played with his kids, and he's quite a great gentleman and quite a humble guy. And that's all. I just wanted to make that comment. Thanks.
All right. Well, okay. You can react to that any way you like, or
I may
not.
Have interviewed the kids. I interviewed some of the neighborhood kids to write this book. Mm-hmm. They had some great stories.
All right. Well, let's just go on. Go to line number two. Hello.
Yes. I haven't read the book. I really would love I look forward to reading it. But I just was taken aback when I saw him interviewed on, I think it was Charlie Rose, and Charlie was asking him about how many people work for him. And maybe I misheard this, but I think he said about 10 people work for him, primarily for taxes, for purpose of filing his taxes. And I just found it mind-boggling, you know, that this fellow who makes this kind of money would have so few people. Maybe I'm completely misunderstanding this, but also something that's interesting about him. I mean, could you explain, in your view, maybe you suggest this in the book, but, you know, he clearly is a humble man in many ways. And do you think that's related to this notion that, unlike a lot of other very, very wealthy people, that he doesn't see himself as simply self-made? I think it seems very clear that he doesn't seem to view it that way. And in that connection, maybe he does relate more to, let's say, the Democrats, the Democratic candidates and so forth. He clearly was expressing this along the way. And, of course, his activity vis-a-vis charity. He seems a very remarkable figure in that regard. But at the same time, with very high moral standards with regard to his family, because I think I heard an interview with his granddaughter, to whom I think he's giving almost nothing, you know. She's an artist, apparently. But in any case, he seemed just like a very interesting figure, and I was curious what you had to say about that.
Okay, I'll take the easy one first. There's about five questions embedded into there.
Sorry about that, yeah.
That's great. They're all great questions. On the staff at Berkshire Hathaway, Berkshire actually has over 230,000 employees, but not very many of them work at headquarters. Warren.
Okay.
Yeah, he likes to keep it simple. He pushes down a lot of the administrative stuff either to the subsidiaries or he outsources it. So, you know, the internal auditors actually don't work for the company. They work at the outside accounting firm. He doesn't like to be controlled. You know, he doesn't have a PR person. He doesn't have a court general counsel. He is his own PR person. You know, he's just very autonomous. It's interesting. He's got a strong degree of self-sufficiency. On your second question, this partly is rooted in the family. The Buffett family for generations has had this egalitarian sense, this dislike of class preferences, of inherited wealth, of feeling of social class. And I saw it traced back to the fact that they were pioneer settlers of Omaha. They arrived, you know, in the time of the railroad before the Civil War, and yet they were tradespeople. They were grocers. They would show up at the back door to make deliveries, whereas the brewers and the department store owners and the bankers looked down on them. And they developed a resentment of classism, and that carried through and shows up to some degree in Warren's politics. Also, Warren and Susie were very involved in the civil rights movement.
Ah.
Warren became also very sensitized to discrimination when he was at Columbia University because he had many Jewish friends and he saw the way they were discriminated against in the 1950s. So there were a number of things that happened that made him feel that the equality of human beings was his highest value. And then coming to your last part about Nicole, my guess is we were going to get to this later in the interview, some of his thoughts on inheritance. David, is that true?
Uh-huh.
Okay, do you want to table that for later?
Well, or if you want to go ahead and respond, you can.
Okay, so Warren, first of all, the Buffett family has always had a tradition of tight-fistedness among the family with their own relatives. And that too started 300 years ago. The first Buffett to come to Omaha came because he was working for his own grandfather, who was so stingy with his wages that he got disgusted and left. And Warren has always had some issues with his children and not giving them money and being fairly withholding. One of his sons told me, you know, if he took us to the movies, you couldn't count on him paying for the popcorn. So, you know, his daughter was pregnant and needed to renovate her tiny kitchen, and she wanted a small loan, and he said, go to the bank. So there was great wealth in the family, and yet the children didn't have access to the money. And this is extended down to the grandchildren, and none of the grandchildren got money from him. He's never given, you know, he's always paid for their college education. But what happened with Nicole, Nicole is his son Peter's adopted granddaughter. He has, I believe, 8 adopted grandchildren, is that in 2006, She went on Oprah and sort of complained that she hadn't had access to the money and made herself a spokesman. And at that time, Warren began giving his grandchildren a small gifts at Christmas, and he excluded her from that. And he wrote her a letter and said, "I don't consider you my granddaughter." It was a really harsh reaction. You know, he is very possessive about his money, and he's very possessive of the Buffett name. And anyone who takes that name and makes themselves a spokesman for the family risks what is called in the family the Buffett name police. So she ran afoul of the name police, and also she threatened the money. You know, it's a complicated relationship. They all have money as part of their very being, and that's been true, again, for generations. Warren's sister, Bertie, whom I just adore, but when she's anxious, she pays bills to relax. You know, they have a different relationship with money than most families, and they, to such a degree, they don't even realize it themselves, and it's hard for them to let go of money.
Yeah, I mean, actually, with the granddaughter, I didn't actually understand at all the negative side of it necessarily, and certainly him being upset at her. But on the other hand, when you look at the American, contemporary American, one of the contemporary American lifestyles of just spending, 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 and I have a sibling who told me, well, everyone's in debt. That's just how America works. And so I find Buffett quite refreshing in that regard. There's certainly, you know, there are complications with the family. And any man who would go to Columbia and then return to Omaha for the rest of his life is extremely interesting, to say the least, and I have a great respect for that. But thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, he has a saying that his children should have enough money to do anything but not enough to do nothing. And, you know, while they had some issues when they were younger, I think they would all say, they have all said, that they really appreciate now the effort that Warren and Susie went to solve the conundrum that rich people have raising children who are neither entitled nor feel stifled nor feel denied. And it's a real conundrum if you've got a lot of money, and I think they struck a pretty good balance.
Mm. You certainly can understand, you know, his famous position about inherited wealth and thinking that rather than just having all that money handed to his children, he was saying, well, if they want to make $1 billion, let them go out and make their own billion, and it shouldn't just fall into their laps. At the same time, you would wonder, well, don't you want to do things for your kids? And we're not talking about you giving them $1 billion. Maybe we're talking about you helping them when they truly need help, or in some kind of a small way, and that would seem to go beyond principle to some level of I don't know, tight-fistedness as a matter of principle.
It's the kind of familial loyalty that any parent would normally have, and that's where it surprises people. Yeah. Because it's not a question of handing over millions; it's a question of helping with little things. And you know, he's gotten much more generous in recent years. And I think that's where, to his credit, he's come around. You know, he's really changed, and I think that's great.
All right, let's talk with some other callers here. Next is someone in Urbana, here where we are, line 3. Hello.
Well, listening to this, I'm reminded of my father-in-law, who's now gone, but who was raised on a farm once the Depression went to got a loan from a local Jewish department store owner in Worcester, Ohio, and to go to Harvard, and who was always fairly tight-fisted, but not quite to this extent, didn't have that same quite amount of money, but he did a lot of estates, and one of his rules that he passed on to his clients was that it's a whole lot better to pay taxes than to spoil children and to give them more money than they can. Well, the things that you've talked about. But I wanted to say that I'm aware that Warren Buffett has done some really good things with his money. For one thing, he was he helped Grinnell College, which has an ethic of giving back to the world that it wants to, that tries to instill in its students, and fairly low tuition for a private school. And he helped them with their investing their endowment. And he's also, as I'm sure many people know, has given a huge chunk of money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to manage and disperse to do good things in this world. and decided to do that because it was more efficient for them to do it than for him. And he's also really spoken up strongly to say, you know, my secretary pays more taxes than I do, or and not maybe quite, not quite right, but he feels that she that he is not paying enough taxes compared to the people who work for him, and based on what they make. And I don't know whether he was one of the people that talked Bill Gates into freeing up some of his money and doing some good things in the world. It's so I wanted to say those things for the guy.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Right. Well, you can, Ms. Schroeder, you can react to that any way you like.
Sure. You know, he and Bill have been talking about philanthropy for a long, long time, and I think Bill Gates probably knows more about that subject than anybody because he treats it as a full-time job and reads a lot of books. And Warren had always intended to give his money away, but he never planned to give it away before he died. But his trust in Bill and Melinda is so great that after his wife Susan, Warren's wife Susan died in 2004, he decided that he would go ahead and give the bulk of his fortune away, and most of it is going to the Gates Foundation. A sizable amount is going to his family foundations, which are managed by his children, but most of it to the Gates. Grinnell College is an interesting story, and I wrote quite a lot about that in the book because it's the only university that he's ever been involved with, and he did so because his friend Joe Rosenfield was chairman of the finance committee, and because he got involved with it through the civil rights movement. Warren went to hear Dr. Martin Luther King speak at a convocation in 1968 in Grinnell just before Dr. King was assassinated, and he was thunderstruck by this speech and something that King said, which is, let me make sure I quote this correctly, that the laws are not to change the heart, but to restrain the heartless. And Warren ended up going on the board as a trustee of Grinnell and spent decades on the investment committee and helped build Grinnell into, I believe, on a per capita, per student basis, the second wealthiest college in the United States after Harvard.
We have about 10, maybe 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have some other callers here. I want to keep going and also mention again, if you're interested in reading about the life of Warren Buffett, you want to look at the new book, The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, published by Bantam, by our guest, Alice Schroeder. Our next caller up is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm thinking you mentioned in terms of his reaction to the book, but it'd be interesting to see his reaction over time. Because actually you served as, it's become reflective, wouldn't you, that aspect of it, for him. You get the point I'm making or not?
I think I understand you correctly. You know, the book, I believe, accomplishes what he set out for it to accomplish. And I think, you know, anybody in his position would feel this way. I mean, I would never have done what he did. And I think it was really courageous of him. I don't know of any other businessman who've done this. If you look at the typical biography of a businessman, they're usually very flattering books written by people that are can be trusted to say only nice things. And I think he deserves tremendous credit. And I think that over time, you know, I think that I hope you're right, that he'll get much more comfortable with it. And I should say, by the way, that, you know, he and I are not, I mean, when I said that I was taking the risk that we'd never speak again, that hasn't happened. It's awkward, but we're still, you know, we're still in contact with each other. And, in fact, he gives out big boxes of See's candy for Christmas, and my box arrived this week. So.
But it was only a half a box, right?
No, it's actually, he sent a 4-pound box. It's more chocolate than you could ever eat in your lifetime, and this thing showed up, and I was like, here comes the calorie fest.
Maybe he wants it to go the other way, then.
Yeah.
Gain the weight. Well, good.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to line number 4, Davenport, Iowa. Hello.
Yes. I admire a lot of things that I've heard about in Warren, and particularly the thrift and disinterest in material things. But the question I wanted to ask you was, if he hadn't earned $60 billion, let's just say that he had been some old boy that retired after an average career as a broker with Merrill Lynch, do you think that this kind of book would have been written? And if it had been, do you think it would have received any circulation?
No, it wouldn't have been written, and it wouldn't have received any circulation. People are really interested in Warren Buffett because of his first of all, he's been the world's richest man, and of his business success. So if he hadn't been successful, I think people wouldn't be so interested in him. He's a fascinating character. There's a lot of really fascinating characters out there, but they don't get books written about them, and they aren't successful because they haven't accomplished what he's accomplished.
So in one way, then, there's an adversity here in that it recognizes the aggrandizement of wealth in our culture.
Well, the book is, to some extent, a commentary on that. In fact, he comments directly on it several times in the book. He says that when he was at his smartest and knew the most about investing and could have helped people the most, he was 21, and nobody would listen to him because he wasn't rich. And now he says, you know, I could give people the stupidest advice. I could tell them to go invest in, you know, pig farms or something, and everybody would listen to me because I'm rich. There's a lot of irony to this. And there's, I give an example late in the book about how people, you know, pursue him because he's so rich. You know, even celebrities pursue him, and some of the ridiculous things that happen. There's a lot of funny incidents. When you're rich, it makes you smarter, it makes you better looking, and it makes you wittier. And that's one of the
Thank you. Well put.
All right. Thank you. We'll continue here. We'll go next to Urbana. And this is line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, when reading the book Rats in the Grain about the Archer Daniels Midland Company, the name of Warren Buffett's son came up.
Oh, yeah.
And I, quite frankly, forgot all the details with his son, and I think it was Mr. Wiegand, in that. And how did Mr. Buffett react to that?
That is a great story. You know, I wrote about that in the book because I was fascinated by it. First of all, Howie Buffett, Warren's son, told me the whole thing, and then there's been a lot written about it that I used in research. But Howie, first of all, got the job at Archer Daniels Midland, and you could really question whether he should have been there in the first place. Talk about things that happen because your dad is rich. You know, he was put on the board with essentially no business experience, and then he became the investor relations, public relations person. And then when this scandal broke, which was the largest bid rigging case in the history of the United States, they rigged the price of a component of lysine, which is a chicken feed component.
Yes.
Howie didn't know anything about it and wasn't involved, but he had an FBI agent showing up in his living room, and he called his father for advice, and he said, "What should I do? I'm the public relations person for this company. My name goes on the press releases." And Warren said to him, "You do what you want. It's up to you to decide. Just know this. You've got 24 hours to decide."
Wow.
Because if you stay... No, you know, Howie was like, "But, you know, I don't know if they're guilty. Shouldn't I give them the presumption of innocence?" And Warren said, "You've got 24 hours to decide, because if you do that and you stay and they're guilty, you're one of them." And Howie realized what that meant, and he quit on the spot, and he ended up being essentially the only member of senior management whose career wasn't tainted by this. It was great advice.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Go to another caller here in Champaign County. This is line three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I heard you before, and I missed the part in the earlier interview that his father was a stockbroker and politician, and that sort of changes my whole perception of him. I remember him sort of being a bean-counting little kid, but I don't know. That just seems like that's an important feature. And I wanted to try to ask a question about how his wife fixed him up with a secretary in several senses of the word. But before I do that... Here's a sort of a simple business question. Are there many stocks, investment sort of vehicles that are valued like his stock is? Is that a common thing? I am not a stock fancier at all, and I just wonder what that means and what that does. It certainly would keep people who really shouldn't be gambling with their money out of the out of his business. I don't know if that's the reason why, but is it a common thing? I mean, because I don't know what it is now, but it used to be about $18,000 per stock, right?
Well, I'm going to deliver a shock to you, because what our caller is referring to is the price of Berkshire A shares, which is currently about $100,000 a share, and there's nothing else like it. It's the highest priced stock probably in the world, certainly in the United States. Warren paid $7.50 a share for it when he started buying it. So it's been an extraordinary situation. It is a deterrent. It makes it sort of like a club to own that stock. And Warren likes it because it's unique, and he likes being unique. But to make it more affordable for ordinary people to invest, there's another class of stock called the B shares. And the B shares trade for about $3,000 a share. So they're still expensive, but, you know, you can go buy, you know, a few of them, and you can be a Berkshire shareholder. I didn't own the stock when I was writing the book because I felt like it was a conflict of interest. But recently, Berkshire got really cheap, and I bought some B shares. And your other question, I'm sorry.
I think
well,
it was
I
about
didn't
this,
actually formulate it very well because I don't really know how to do it. But
this unconventional living arrangement
oh, yes.
that he had.
Oh, yeah, that. How could I forget? okay, so Warren and his wife, Susan, had a marriage that was like many in which he was the breadwinner and she was the wife who raised the children, and everything revolved around his career, everything. And in the beginning, that was fine. That was how Susie wanted it, and they both wanted it that way. It was extreme. Warren was obsessively focused on work, but Susie was the kind of person who wanted to be someone who took care of every need of her husband. But in the 1960s, in the late 60s, early 70s, as happened in a lot of American families, she became a woman and wanted to roar, and she wanted more. She did not any longer want to be in a one-way relationship, and so they started living essentially separate lives. And by 1977, she moved to San Francisco, but the curious thing was they remained married. Warren was incredibly dependent on her emotionally and almost couldn't function without her. And so they talked on the phone every day. Meanwhile, he's pretty helpless when it comes to getting along day to day without having a woman to take care of him. I mean, he can barely comb his hair. He's really, it's kind of, you know, he's very dependent. So Susie got one of her friends, Astrid Minx, to start going over to the house and cook a meal for him, and just kind of within 5 months, they had started a relationship and they moved in together. The last thing on earth that Warren Buffett would ever want would be to be a polygamist, but it ended up happening that he was living with one woman and married to another, and that it was a little bit of an uneasy relationship, but they worked it out. Susie and Astrid were friends. Astrid was the Omaha wife, in effect, and Susie was the public Mrs. Warren Buffett. And for 20-some-odd years, that was how it remained.
And when Susie died, then he married Astrid.
That's right. 2 years after Susie's death in 2006, he married Astrid.
Now, this is the kind of thing where, well, first of all, I suppose it's the kind of thing where you would say, well, if this arrangement was agreeable to all parties, then it was just kind of their business. Though in this particular case, now that he's actually told the story and it's public and it's out there in the book, you know, you wonder why it is that someone would reveal something that to a lot of people would be pretty scandalous and beyond the pale.
You know, it's interesting because Warren was always completely open and above board about this. Warren values honesty to an almost indescribable degree, and he felt that people have a right to live their life. He feels that people have a right to live their lives the way they choose. He doesn't like to dictate anything to people, and he feels the same about his own life. Someone brought up taxes earlier. You know, he does think that rich people should pay taxes, but he thinks that people have a right to do what they want with their own money. He doesn't like people who think, you know, that they should dictate other people's charitable preferences. So in this case, he felt that by being very open about it, that was what was required. Susie, on the other hand, was, I would call her secretive. And, for example, the one person who didn't know about this was her father. And everybody else knew because she insisted that her father not be told. Susie also had another relationship, but she kept it a secret.
I wonder what Warren's father would have thought about this.
Well, yeah. Warren's father was somewhat of a Victorian, and he died in 1964. I don't think he would have loved it, but, you know, Warren didn't have to deal with that problem.
Yeah.
You know, Warren's mother was still alive. She dealt fine with it.
We're close here to the end. I want to try and at least maybe get one more caller in. We'll go to a caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. An interesting quote from Mr. Buffett. when you get what you want, that's success. When you want what you get, that's happiness. I'll ring off. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know. As far as you know, did he actually say that? Or does that ring true with what you know?
It sounds just like him. I can't cite the source, but that's both he and his partner, Charlie Munger, have a belief that so much of life is about not having expectations that are unreasonable, and that envy in particular is the one sin that's guaranteed to make you miserable. Of the seven deadly sins, you know, gluttony and some of the others are kind of fun, but, you know, envy is just guaranteed misery, and wanting what you can't have is just a terrible mistake.
All right, we'll try and go one more. We'll go champagne here, line two. Hello.
I enjoy all of this, but I did read something that really caused me pause about Mr. Buffett, and I guess I should figure every human being has faults. I'm talking about a book I recently read by David K. C-A-Y. Johnston. The title of the book is Free Lunch, and the subtitle is How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and, of course, Stick You with the Bill. And I guess I'm one of the yous, the poor taxpayer. And one of the people highlighted extensively through the book is Mr. Warren Buffett, how he has made a lot of his largesse, a lot of his wealth through government subsidy, has played hardball in that regard, and that he has had interest-free loans that have existed for 28 years from the government, and the government is paying for that. And, of course, the government never pays for anything. It's the taxpayers. So I just want to see how you look at that side of Mr. Buffett.
Sure. Well, I think probably what Mr. Johnson was referring to was the insurance companies that Berkshire Hathaway owns, which, you know, they get money from their customers and they invest it before they pay it out in claims. And that's how all insurance companies work. It's not exactly a tax dodge. It's just the nature of insurance. And there's been there's been talk at different times of changing the way insurance companies are taxed, but I don't think anybody should volunteer. And then one of the cardinal principles, in fact, there's been a Supreme Court case about it, is that, you know, no one's expected to volunteer to pay taxes that aren't required by the tax code. Warren definitely does not invest or make decisions on how much tax he can avoid. He's made a number of statements that he thinks investments should be taxed more heavily than they are. He benefits a lot from the Bush administration's tax policies on investments, and he has voted and done everything in the world to try to get Democrats elected who would tax him personally more heavily than he is. So, you know, he puts his votes where they would cause him to have to pay more. But the tax system has consistently gotten skewed toward making rich people richer through charging them less taxes. And he has benefited from that, and he would be the very first person to say so, and he thinks it's wrong and morally wrong. He's given the money to Bill and Melinda Gates instead, and I would argue that's a better way to spend it than to write a check to Washington.
We're going to have to leave it at that because we're at the end of the time. The book is The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life by our guest Alice Schroeder. It's published by Bantam. Ms. Schroeder, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, the show first broadcast December 16th. Coming up in the next hour, another archive conversation, this one with historian Neil Ferguson. We talked in December of last year about his recent book, The Ascent of Money. That's hour number two. WILO programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. Right now, we'll take our usual break for an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session in the grain pits. Prices are showing a softer tone. despite the equity markets at 78.31, up 169 points and making a new high for its move off of its earlier lows. And let's go ahead and go right to the picks and get the latest. In Kansas City, May wheat at 575 is down 13. July, 585.5, down 13.5. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 523.5, now 523.25, down 11.75. July, 536, down 11.5. May corn, 388.25, down 5.5. July, 398.25, down 6. December, 419.75, down 5.5. May crude, 53.88, down 10 cents. April ethanol, 158, down 2.4. The April RBOB, 150.3, and it is up 0.04. May beans, 958.75, down 8.25. July, 9.